bodies get settling a bit. I was born in North Dakota. That's not true, I was born in South Dakota, really. But they are divided only by whites. It's the same territory. I was born in Mobridge, actually, a few miles from Sitting Bull's grave. And my parents celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary last year, which was rather fun because Christianity in Crisis said right before their anniversary that I was 55 years old, which gave a lot of humor to the celebration, actually. But Christianity in Crisis was wrong. I will turn 50 this summer and am delighting in it. Part of why I bring this up is that at the anniversary of my parents' wedding, I heard a story about myself that was new. One of the first words I learned was outside, except I shortened it at the age of whatever to out. Now, in Selby, South Dakota, out is dry prairie or blizzards, that's about it. But my parents told me that any time they took me as an infant outside, and as soon as I learned how to talk, they would bring me in, and my first word inside would be out. So I was relieved to hear this story, this mythology of myself from my parents, because it helped me understand why I have, from as long as I can remember, been a deep friend of the so-called natural world, of outside. I can remember in the Dakotas, in fact, after doing the dishes in the evening, getting on my bicycle, Bluebird, which isn't that, I didn't even realize, Bluebird, of course I'd have a name like that for my bike. After doing the dishes, I would get on Bluebird, which I got because I got straight A's in second grade. It's a serious bribery going on. And I would ride to the edge of Scotland, South Dakota, and look at the prairie, looking west. And I realized only much later that I didn't know anything about the people who had lived there before my ancestors. My grandparents, three out of the four, all immigrated from Russia and settled farm country in North Dakota. And it is part of my ambivalence about life that is in that experience in the Dakotas. I love the prairies. I love being outside. And at the same time, I realized that this land that I love so dearly has been stolen. And every delight that I take in it has that other side to it. And part of my struggle in trying to understand God and land and spirit has to do with that deep ambivalence that runs through my own experience. I want to read first a passage out of this little book that I carry with me all the time. It's full of, I might have more coherent identity than I realize now that I think about it. It's full of pressed flowers, none of them illegally picked, at least insofar as I would admit it publicly. I want to read something that I wrote that connects with that Dakota experience on the 22nd of November, 1990. And this was written sitting near Boston College in Boston, Massachusetts, where there's a big water reservoir for drinking. And it'll become clear what's going on there. I am sitting on the rocks in the park at the reservoir with the sun nearing the hill horizon. Some crows are very upset. Squirrels are busy beating the coming frost. People walk very noisily through dry leaves on the paths around me. And I am aching in my heart for what happened to the Lakota. Having just seen Dances with Wolves, I yearn to undo history, to roll it back, rewind like film, and replace the bloody invasions of this continent with peaceful coexistence. Not leave all my relatives in Germany and Russia, of course, since I would hate never to have lived, and never to have lived in South Dakota, but the cost for such migrating. I delight at this moment in the sunlight off the water, the late afternoon, early winter light on clumps of long grass around the boulder-built hill, the light on my loved beech tree, the green of evergreen against the sky, the sunlight through oak leaves, the silhouette of trees on water and sky, the fire of the sun burning righteousness into white skin. The experience of seeing that movie and then thinking about it on what was actually Thanksgiving Day 1990 stayed with me for quite a while, but stays, of course, longer than the felt experience because of the words, which I turn to again and again when I encounter this deep ambivalence I feel about the lands that I love. And that brings me to what a element that was not originally in my presentation this evening, but it happened this morning, and I want to relate it to you because it fits. I hate goodbyes. Just can't stand them. So when this big bus was getting ready to haul off all these wonderful elder hostel people, what do? I take off so I'm not around for goodbyes. Have done this all my life, actually. So I knew where I wanted to go this morning. It was a sensation that I had fairly early this morning that I would go up to the mining, to Winston, to the miners' village, the ruins, because I wanted to do photography. I walked along until I saw the teepee, which I always had wanted to go into. And I opened the flap and was in the teepee, taking, I think, really marvelous photos. Often you can tell when you take a photograph, this is perfection. I mean, there's just no doubt. You just know it. And the two that I really liked were through the roof, and the different light on the cloth of the teepee. It was just exquisite. And it was so exquisite, I don't know how long I was there. I have no sense. So I was taking the photos and opened the flap to go out. And you have to stoop. If you know that white teepee, you lift the flap, and so you're in this stoop position coming out. Open the flap, coming out, and here is a huge brown bear. Well, I tell you, it was one of the most stunning experiences of my life, actually. It was grubbing in this stump, you know. And when you look at these stumps, now, I mean, when I look at them now, I realize why they don't just decay that way. These are bear food places. This bear looked at me, and I looked at the bear, and it did a turn that raised a cloud of dust like you wouldn't believe, and it tore down the hill, and I stood there. I was utterly transported. I still can't, you can tell, I cannot believe this. I said to myself, how should any South Dakota-born white woman have this privilege of being an alien in a teepee? I mean, I was already encroaching on a tradition there in a way that was really white appropriation if I hadn't been so careful to honor what the tradition was, at least emotionally and mentally. And here, this white woman comes out of this teepee and has not a vision, but I must confess, it crossed my mind. Was this a way that the natural world would welcome me, like having a vision in native traditions of a particular animal? After I calmed down, my first thought was, why in the world didn't you click the shutter? I didn't, and it would be awful to have a photo of that bear. But I did a lot of photography after that, about an hour, and whistled the whole time. In part because I didn't really want the bear to sneak up on me when I'm lying flat on the ground so that I could get this iris and the mountain in this shot. So I whistled a great deal, even flat on my side, doing photography. And then as I was coming back down to the road, I was looking at this pine branch for some reason, maybe how the light was striking it, and I saw in this pine branch this long brown strand. And I took it off. I think, I'm going to check with someone who knows, I think it's bear hair, all in this strands, and I've kept it. So that's the most recent strange experience of growing up in South Dakota and then coming to a place like Holden and finding this ambivalence of being a preacher's kid in Christian tradition who loves the land and is Christian still, but wonders about how narrowly we have defined what it means to be Christian. How it's such a, it's not the narrow road that Jesus talked about, it's like the balance beam in the Olympics, and you've got all these people waiting for you to fall off the theological balance beam, so they can sort of go zero. It's a very strange situation. So that brings me to the next element in this prose poem about God and nature. And that is an element which I fought long and hard whether I would use here at Holden. But then I realized if I read it or talked about it at Church Women United, not exactly a group of eco-feminists, although some were there, at the big Jubilee celebration in St. Louis earlier, I can certainly read it at Holden. Some of you know that Holden, that I had never been to Holden Village until last October, for various reasons. So I was very happy to be here, just thrilled, finally, to be at Holden Village. The utopia of Lutheranism, so far as I can tell. That's how people always talk about it. And I was here for 2.5 days, I think, so that meant on the second day that I was here, I had a hike to Holden Lake, because that was the only day to do it in the afternoon that was free. Now, I am not in shape, friends. This is a city woman who walks a lot, but vertical is alien. I do not know vertical. So I hiked to Holden Village, and there were male clergy, a lot of them at this convention, most of them ahead of me on the mountain. And some of them, out of perverse kindness, would keep saying to me, "Oh, Elizabeth, you're almost there." It was awful, because I wasn't almost there. And only 3 people on that whole day told me the truth about how close I was to Holden Lake. But I'm glad that the liars lied. By the time I got to Holden Lake, I was physically in a state that hermits have worked for millennia. You're ready for mystical visions of all sorts, because your body chemistry lends itself to that, requires it actually in my case. I had insufficient water, it was just ridiculous. Plus I was carrying my little Nikon, the big Nikon F, 2 telephoto lenses, and this was just, and hadn't hiked in 20 years. So you can see this is big, revelation on the horizon. I got to Holden Lake. Everybody else had passed me on the way. They were coming back by the time I got to the lake, except 3 people, and they were leaving just as I arrived. So they went over the hill, and I was alone at Holden Lake. And the first thing I did is what I will now describe. I did it, and then I sat immediately and wrote it. So this is contemporary witness. 1 October, Tuesday, Holden Lake. I reached this lake, bent down to the river, and without hesitating, cupped water to my forehead and said each time, "I baptize you in the name of Gaia. I baptize you in the name of Sophia. I baptize you in the name of Jesus." The mountains are moving with a motion born of long memory and longer hope. The autumn colors are matched to the last snow patches of the season. The glaciers look down, solemn, aged, wise, cold, dear. Someone had dropped grapes. They were right at the edge of the water, actually, white ones. I picked them up, washed them in the river, and ate them. This is my body. Thank you, Holy and Great Spirit, for the earth. I want to say something about that. There were many women offended at Church Women United. Question, what is she doing baptizing herself, they said. And I had to explain to them that I don't construe baptism here as a solitary act. I don't construe it as replacing my baptism, which was the 6th of March, 1943, I celebrated every year, and I was baptized into Father, Son, and Holy Spirit baptism, pre-feminist baptism. But this moment came to me utterly unplanned. I had no idea I was going to do this. And I have thought about it frequently since it happened, because I realized that Gaia and Sophia and Jesus aren't mutually exclusive religion systems somehow, but rather they are all ways of talking about a congruent holy, which is, I think, consistent with classical theologies of the incarnation in Christianity. And I hope we can come back to that in a moment. There was other women who were Lutheran who said, this doesn't sound very Lutheran. So I read what happened on the way home from Holden Village last October. Just a note after the fact. This was Doug Hall in the back seat and the Pilgrims, Walt and, can't remember her name, and I in the car driving back for October, returning from Holden to Seattle. Last evening we came upon a car in the ditch, a couple from our meeting. Their car had hit a deer, which lay dead on the edge of the highway, its large brown eyes vacant. This same nature, which was so incredibly present at Holden Lake 2 days earlier, was also there on the side of the ditch and in the people in the car. So the death of that deer is somehow connected with the constant and continuing baptism into new life that those of us who refuse to separate God and nature hope for every day. Now, the last element of that is this pottery. I have always wanted to try pottery of some sort, and this was a wonderful occasion this time here at Holden. And I first made a huge bowl. Terry's a wonderful teacher. Is he good? He really, just lucidity. And for somebody to do work that he does of that beauty with his hands, to be able to translate it into words is a real gift, and he's got it. So I think he enabled us to do things that we couldn't, we really can't do, and this is emotion. So I started with a big pot, sort of like that, and I finished it, and it just wasn't it. So then I thought, well, there's time. I knew I really wanted to do a shape. So I came up with this and did the coloring and the glazing, and it fired then. And this is, I named it, this is Holden Gaia from my experience at the lake. But not only the experience at the lake, I'll pass it around. It's not as fragile as it was before it was fired. I'm not going to say anything more about it. It can be interpreted in multitude of ways, I suppose. But I like it because it's a physical visual symbol that conveys something, I hope, of that experience at the lake. Now, I would like to continue this theme by reflecting on one dimension of our theological tradition that I think makes it most difficult for us to understand nature as a vehicle of true epiphany. You know, Lutherans, especially Orthodox, North American Lutherans of the neo-Orthodox variety, sort of post-World War II, got really big into drawing a distinction between two kinds of revelation. There was general revelation, the kind you could get hiking out here. And then there was specific revelation, and that is exclusively through Jesus of Nazareth as revealed in the scripture and interpreted by systematics profs and bishops. And I learned when I studied through the doctorate that you really cannot get saving knowledge of God through general revelation. You can get saving knowledge of God only through specific revelation, through Jesus. I no longer am even sure what they mean by saving, to be honest about it. I think we use this language by habit, but if we start translating it into other than official language, what are we talking about when we talk about saving or salvation? And I, as a feminist, now understand that whatever it means, it's got to include well-being in this life. It can't be simply after death, whatever salvation is. And well-being is a fairly comprehensive term. In some feminist terminology, it means right relationship as a synonym for justice. So to be in right relationship includes what we would call right relationship with nature. And salvation has to do with that then. And I think that once you understand that God is comprehensively loving, then it's quite possible to say that there is knowledge of salvation through nature. And those who say that you can't know it through nature but only through Jesus are, they're not only being rather narrow-minded. I know from experience with a lot of people, and especially with women, that women sit in the pews of our churches and know that some of our deepest spiritual experiences have been with nature. And we don't dare talk about it in the church because we get called what Elizabeth Bettenhausen has been called by sundry, and that is pagan. And that's the worst put down that for Lutherans, to be called a pagan. A pagan is somebody who loves, well, no, that would be too unkind, so I don't know. But what I want to connect here is one theme of this tradition, and I'm not going to read this paper to you, but I have it in front of me only because it contains some quotations from the ancient story of a Babylonian creation myth and the story of Marduk and Tiamat. And I want to use some of this story because I want to pose a question initially for our discussion. I have in front of me, actually, the paper I'm going to be reading as a keynote for the Lutheran Women's Caucus on Saturday morning out in Minneapolis. But I want to use a part of it here. Several years ago, a poster was published on which was a picture of planet Earth and the caption, "Love Your Mother." Some of you have probably seen that. Might even be here somewhere. On April 22, 1990, ABC Television's The Earth Day Special, some of you might remember this show, starred Robin Williams as Everyman. That's why I watched it, because I watch everything that Robin Williams does. And Bette Midler as Mother Nature. Mother Nature looked garbage-ridden but hardly emaciated as she lay in intensive care in the Everytown America Hospital. Obviously, she had Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or some other insurance, since she had no difficulty getting admitted right away and getting a bevy of specialists to try to bring her back to health. How many women sat in the emergency rooms in hospitals around the country that night, waiting for the only medical care they can afford, namely free? What injury or illnesses brought them to the hospital? While television dramatized Mother Nature's near demise, during those 2 hours in the United States, at least 20 women were raped, 400 women were beaten, 4 were murdered, 6 children were sexually molested, and those are all the low end of the statistics. During Earth Day 1990, speakers called for an end to the rape of Mother Earth, a favorite metaphor. In 20 states in the United States, wife rape is not a crime if the husband and wife are living together. The earth as goddess is as ancient as religion and nearly as old as the violence against her. In the early days of the second millennium before the Common Era, Mesopotamians composed an epic, the Enuma Elish, to restore cosmic order at the beginning of each new year. It's like toasts and whistles and hats in the US. In the epic, Marduk, who is the most honored of the great gods, firstborn yet presiding over his fathers, is addressed by the assembly of gods. And they say, "Lord, truly thy decree is first among gods. Stay but to wreck or create, it shall be. Open thy mouth, the cloth will vanish. Speak again, and the cloth shall be whole." At the word of his mouth, the cloth vanished. He spoke again, and the cloth was restored. When the gods, his fathers, saw the fruit of his word, joyfully they did homage. Marduk is king. They conferred on him scepter, throne, and vestment. They gave him matchless weapons that ward off the foes. Go and cut off the life of Tiamat. May the winds bear her blood to places undisclosed. That's the New Year's ritual. Who was Tiamat? Anybody know? Tiamat was the primordial goddess, the great goddess mother, Dia Mater. and Marduk accuses her of stirring up conflict. Sound familiar? He accuses her of turning sons against their fathers, of refusing to love him, her own son, of taking a lover to replace her husband. Having thus both charged and convicted her, Marduk engages the goddess mother in battle, and he murders her. And the epic continues. When Tiamat opened her mouth to consume him, he drove in the evil wind, but she closed not her lips. As the fierce winds charged her belly, her body was distended and her mouth was wide open. He released the arrow, it tore her belly. It cut through her inside, splitting the heart. Having thus subdued her, he extinguished her life. He cast down her carcass to stand upon it. The Lord trod on the legs of Tiamat. With his unsparing mace, he crushed her skull. When the arteries of her blood he had severed, the north wind bore it to places undisclosed. On seeing this, his fathers were joyful and jubilant. They brought gifts of homage, they to him. Then the Lord paused to view her dead body, that he might divide the monster and do artful works. He split her like a shellfish into two parts. Half of her he set up and sealed it as sky, pulled down the bar and posted guards. He bade them to allow not her waters to escape. He crossed the heavens and surveyed the regions. Marduk, son of Tiamat, killed his mother, creator of the world. He divides her into waters above the firmament and below the firmament. Tiamat becomes, in Hebrew mythology, Tehom, the deep. In the Genesis myth, Marduk's ability to effect creation solely by the word is attributed to Yahweh. The mother is suppressed. Goddess mother, Dia Mater, source of matter of the material world, has become God Father, speaker of creation. In his image, human beings firstborn were charged with dominion over all the creatures of the sea and of the earth and over the very earth itself. And you remember in Genesis when it says that the spirit moved over the deep? That is the Hebrew version of this Mesopotamian myth of Tiamat, Tehom, the deep. As the 500th anniversary approaches, I've been thinking of a rhyme we learned as children. Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. The ocean blue seemed very far away from North Dakota, where I lived as a grade schooler, and Spain did too. But so far as we knew, the ocean was blue in the 20th was as blue in the 20th century as it had been in the 15th. Christopher Columbus discovered America and came a long way to do it. Christopher Marduk Columbus, sailing over Great Tiamat, conquering her once again. Only years later did I realize how automatically we stood with Columbus on the three saintly ships, we German and Finnish and Norwegian, more recently immigrants. Reciting the rhyme, we did not think of ourselves as standing on the shores, looking across the surf to see these unexpected strangers. Our sentiments were not so audacious as the t-shirts for sale last summer in Boston, which said in the Italian north end of Boston, America, we discovered it, we named it, we built it. But it never dawned on us in South Dakota or North Dakota that the discovery of America was other than God's will. The Ogallala and the Yankton and the Chippewa were invisible. I do not recall that my favorite radio program's second character, Tonto, ever had his tribe mentioned in the program. The Dakota have a word for the earth community. All are my relations. The people of the seven fireplaces also have a word for the Europeans who killed the bison for profit. Wasichu, he who takes the fat. Alice Walker uses this word in her collection of poems, Horses Make a Landscape Look More Beautiful. The poem is called Who. Who has not Wasichu, he who eats the fat? Who is that? The whites. Okay. Almost everybody in this room. Who? Who has not been invaded by the Wasichu? Not I, said the people. Not I, said the trees. Not I, said the waters. Not I, said the rocks. Not I, said the air. Moon, we hoped you were safe. The Wasichu today finds fat in the violation of the old treaties in Wisconsin, in New York, at the Four Corners. Eating the fat, the Wasichu does not thank the bison or the trees for making life possible. Calculates the value added by killing. The Dakota and Lakota peoples live in Rosebud and Pine Ridge and the west side of Chicago. The blue ocean subdued by Columbus was soon streaked with the placenta of birth in the holds of slave ships. The Wasichu calculated the value added by enslaving. And a concluding paragraph. After the dismembering of Tiamat, the winds bore her blood to places undisclosed, as the myth puts it. Was this the red streak from slave ships in the Atlantic? The red stains seeping into the Missouri and the Mississippi from the gunshot wounds in the Ogallala and Yankton and Sisseton peoples? The red stain soaking the snow as seal pups are beaten? The red stain soaking the dish towel wrapped around the forehead of the battered pregnant wife? The red stain running from sliced steers into what was once the ground of the tropical rainforest? Can an earth community be built on the blood of Tiamat? Now, that would not be sufficient without one more reference for conversation. I think that the Lutheran theological understanding of the masks of God enables us to talk about creation in a way that can redeem Tiamat as well as the earth itself. That is, can redeem the feminine, which nature has always been understood to be in the West, from its oppression in the theology, which subordinates nature to a sky god that has been construed as exclusively masculine and even male. Now, if that, I hope, is provocative enough, we can have some conversation about this, I hope, because as is clear, my theological understanding of all this is underway and in no sense complete. So I need all the help I can get and hope that you can share with each other as well. Any comments or questions? Or objections?
Yeah. Can you say just a little bit more about the masks of God?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You opened that, that opening. What do you mean by that?
I think that Luther was right in understanding, as you alluded to in the formula tonight, that it is not possible to be anywhere in the universe and be separate from God. That the holy pervades absolutely everything, which is technically panentheism. In that theological word, it's not saying that what is God, but it's saying that everything that is permeated by God. This is tough to think about if your primary image of God is the big white man in the sky, like in Alice Walker's The Color Purple, and like many of us were raised with. How in the world can my grandfather, that was my image of God, be pervading this clock? Be pervading my hair, everything. So I think that behind the masks of God is Luther's understanding that there is no material, essential split between the holy and the material world. Rather, he was fairly adamant in understanding that God is for us always mediated. We do not have immediate access to God. Even if those people who think that they commune with God inside their heads, there's a lot of stuff up in there, material stuff that's mediating God. The masks of God then means that if you look around, it is not self-evident that the ultimate outcome of the universe is sheer loving grace and justice. And you can't look at George Bush's policy and say, my God, how great you are, because they conflict in my theology. And you can't look at the destruction that can be effected by the natural world, in quotations, and conclude from that that perfection has been reached ecologically either. It hasn't. There's a great deal of unright relationship of those fault lines in injustice in the universe that we saw in the slides from the geology lectures, where you can just see how the Earth shifted dramatically. And the world doesn't fit in justice terms either. So you can't look out and say, I look at the universe and it's self-evident that God is love. So but at the same time, even in the greatest shit, to use Luther's favorite theological word, even in the worst crap, that is precisely where God is. So these masks are both the gorgeous sunset and the sexually abused four-year-old girl. Both of them manifest God, but they are masks in the sense that we can't see this pure love. Friends, there is a ground squirrel pulling the longest out there on the lawn. Look at that. You see, it was pulling that long ribbon that stretched all along the lawn there. The cutest thing. Excuse me, I was just looking straight at it. It was really a riot. And Luther would say, well, if you understand, look at it, pulling it all the way down off the lawn.
You trained him as part of your presentation?
No, I didn't, actually. I think in some ways Lutherans have too much identified the mass of God with the theology of the cross, so that it's only in injustice that we would name a mask of God. And the real challenge for Lutherans is to see God in joy and to see God in erotic pleasure, in the good things. Because the first thing that happens is you say, I was at Holden Village and had this gorgeous experience of God, and somebody will say theology of glory. You can just hear it already, that you're somehow lapsing over into the worst of Calvinism. Well, these outdated theological debates aren't going to get us the New World Order that we need. I just don't believe. So that's an initial response. Other comments or issues? What happened to Gaia, by the way? Is she still around?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. No, I don't want her back necessarily. I just want
to
know where she
is.
Yes.
I have something that's bothering me, and I need to put that out.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that we talk about God. Is God and nature compatible? And it seems to me that your answer is yes, of course. That, you know, part of the that God cannot be separated from nature, that, like you talk about saving, that to try to understand saving, if there's anything that we could relate to that, would be like nature, you know, our understanding of nature. Well, anyway, what I'm trying to get is that your work with photographs and the fact that you use a camera, I have a problem with that, because for me a camera is the symbol of all my materialistic world. You know, that I imagine a camera and I see how much energy is being taken from the earth, how much the earth has been raped to produce cameras and TV and things like that. And I wonder how do you deal with that? Do you?
I think it's a very, very good question, because in fact, when partly by necessity, when my income dropped dramatically 4 years ago, I was fired from a job, and I was earning $36,000, and I dropped down to about 10 initially. So I was confronted with a great option for reducing my consumption level, because I had to. So partly because of that, but also out of moral commitment, I have been very seriously working on reducing my consumption. I hardly ever buy clothing. I usually sew anything that I can. I don't have an automobile. I don't have a VCR. I don't have a microwave. And I will not buy those things, precisely for the reason that you're saying. However, I do have a camera. I've bought two in my life, one in 1964 and the other, I think, in 84. So I use one about every 20 years. So it's not exactly exuberant consumption. But I am making a moral judgment, and that is that buying this camera and using the film, I mean, it's not the camera so much, it's the film and the paper that's really a consumption issue. The chemicals and the pollution, it's a serious moral question. I have decided that I will be able to raise the bigger questions of consumption better if I do this photography. The bigger questions of consumption are questions like, can an economy based on so-called free market enterprise keep employment at a level which means we don't have guaranteed 10% in poverty in the United States without doing serious damage to the ecology, to the environment? That's the big question for me that you raise. I think I can raise that big question about the structuring of this economy and how we decide who's employed and employable and unemployed better if I'm sane than if I'm nuts. And I was for 3 years without a camera when my Zeiss Econ died, which I bought in 1964, and I was going crazy, absolutely going crazy, because I was, well, we don't have to go into all that. I'm a Lutheran. I'm still a Lutheran for just reasons that
baffle you, I hope.
Baffle me. Because I try to get out all the time and I never quite make it, so I'm still a Lutheran. But there's, and I'm not going to be Baptist or anything, I mean, it's just, I'm Christian, that's the basic. But I'm Lutheran, which means that I can handle that kind of moral mess. Because I'm not into moral perfectionism, I'm really not. And I'm not going to get all hung up about that kind of my level of consumption. I try to do what I can. I'm a vegetarian, and I do what I can, but I'm certainly going to trust justification by grace through faith for the sake of Jesus Christ stuff.
Thank you.
You want me to be a perfectionist?
No, it was just a question. I don't know how you deal with that.
Yeah.
To give you a nightmare tonight?
No, I refuse. That's why I became a Lutheran, because I was tired of nightmares. I didn't want to have to be in, I didn't want to have to wake up in the morning and feel tremendous about being on the planet only if I had obtained some sort of perfection. And you can really get nightmares if you think that you don't dare wake up unless you wake up and be perfect all day.
Well, that's the problem.
So I read Luther.
The only thing that I see is that I see people easily criticize and try to save the planet and the earth, but they are not willing to give up their comfort.
Their TV,
their camera, they go around and they like to take pictures. You know, and that really bothers me because they always, you know, talk about how things are beautiful, how things are great, God created everything. And at the same time, they don't really think of what they're doing. They're participating in that destruction by having all that material things in their life.
That gives me VEAU. That gives me an opportunity to make another point. I now understand something that you're saying I didn't before. I have long been taught to think that these two, the true and the good, were really more important than the beautiful. And my graduate study in theology and ethics led me to think that, although it wasn't as bad as it could have been. And I think a lot of preaching leads us to think this, that the truth and the good, the morally good, the righteous, are really the key things for religious people. And I've since having more free time in part, not being employed full-time anymore, I think I have been able to attend to some of this in a more intensive fashion than I had before. And I began to realize that I do not have to justify anymore this one. I don't have to rationalize my love of the beautiful. What is true and what is beautiful and what is good are equally important. And it is, I won't in that sense apologize for the film, because I aspire to photograph in such a way that beauty is apparent. It's not always morally, I don't always photograph the morally good. I hope I always photograph the truth insofar as I'm able to discern it, and I hope to discern it with others. But I won't apologize for, it's like asking, it's like, and I'm not comparing myself now with, say, Georgia O'Keeffe, one of my favorite artists, but it's like, should she apologize for buying canvas and paint? Would you say, and I'm not comparing myself to Georgia O'Keeffe, but would you say to her she should give that up so she doesn't consume?
Yeah.
But she's dead now.
I would say.
Okay. How much art, how much visual art are you going to leave us on this planet, in your theory?
The visual art?
Yeah. How much visual, human-produced beauty are you going to leave us?
Well, there's the nature, it's already visual art.
Okay, so we're going to have nature.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, you can have some kind of art that, you know, that can be, like the Native Americans have some art, but they didn't really, they work with the nature in their art. And it seems to me that our camera, those things are not in agreement with the cycle of nature.
But flinting the stone to scrape the deer skin before painting the deer skin was just as much technology as the camera is.
But they're not destroying as much the earth as it is with
I think we're getting into some hair-splitting gradations that we really don't need to dwell on.
Could be, but maybe not.
A question that was raised that I'd like to explore is how it's easy to use the justification by grace, and how it's easy to support conspicuous consumption and materialism by saying, well, that's okay because I'm saved by grace.
Yeah. St. Paul knew about that problem, didn't he?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Do you want us to talk about that, or it's a useful point? Why don't you start?
Where does grace fail? I mean, where are we? You know, where are we called out on our? Where do we have to start taking responsibility?
Do you know Dorothea Sörmann's work, the German political theologian? By any chance, ever read her? You might want to take a look at some of her work, because she is the best one that I know so far, who talks, along with José Miguel Bonino from Argentina, liberation theologian. And what both of them talk about is a very useful thing to think about. They say that in the West, we have made a very serious theological mistake, and that is we have used the teeter-totter understanding of power. And here are human beings, and here is God. And any time in Western theology, any time we say that God is powerful, the teeter-totter has to go this way. Human beings get less power. It's a zero-sum understanding of power, in other words. And that means, it's related to what you've just asked in this way, it means that we have really deprecated human agency a lot. Human agency is suspect, and it got even more suspect under the fear of works righteousness in certain understandings of the Lutheran tradition, drawing on Paul. But the mistake is not grace. It's not grace's fault that human beings cop out all the time in the pursuit of justice in the world. The mistake is in construing this understanding of human and divine agency in this competitive model. You can say, I am made right with the universe solely by God's grace. God pervades the universe. God is sheer love with a good dose of judging wrath built in, because God doesn't like injustice. And ultimately, this all shall be well. You can say that and still argue that human beings are the agents of mediating that grace to the planet. Not the exclusive agents, but are responsible agents for doing it.
But I see so many people not refusing to take, or so many people refusing to take that responsibility.
Oh yeah, Adam was asleep while Eve was talking with the serpent. And that's, it's, you're very right, and it's a very serious problem, but it's a long-standing one. And how do you inspire people to not to work against their own self-interest? I mean, that's the same thing, that it's self-interest or other interest as mutually exclusive patterns of behavior. This is ridiculous to do it that way. But how do you enable people to understand that it's okay to love yourself and it's okay to love your neighbor? I'm not, very frankly, I think it's almost impossible in our culture. And by our, I mean consuming white middle-class Christian culture in the United States. I think that the gospel and our lifestyle of late dying capitalism are almost completely incompatible. That's nicely hyperbolic. Are you going to react to that?
I think that's, I agree.
Oh, well, then you aren't going to react. Anybody just...
I think that maybe we all in this room have rationalized and, you know, used more Earth's resources than we needed to, just by the mere fact that we are here at Holden Village, and we've had to fly on planes, go on boats, drive cars to get up here. In order for Holden Village to exist, we have to, you know, cut down 500 trees a year. We ship oil up here. I mean, if we were really concerned about, you know, just the environment and the Earth, we would not be going to all the trouble to come up here in the first place.
But we're part of Earth too.
Well, I know. I mean, I've just been saying we can't, you know, be pointing around other, you know, fingers at other people, because after all, we are here. And we come here for the beauty and the experience.
Was there a yes that I just heard, or?
I just agree.
Oh, okay. I can't quite, the light in here doesn't show faces, so I can't read them.
I'm worried a little bit about this kind of, I'm worried about the kind of thinking that acknowledges, as I think we must, that we're all implicated in the problem. The problem being, in this case, conserving and loving the Earth. And that therefore, since we're all implicated, then we're in no position to make the kind of judgments and the kind of discriminations needed to distinguish between the kind of position you outlined and worked through autobiographically, really, when you were answering the question about the camera, and the kind of gross character of American consumer society. In other words, it can lead to the attitude, and this is the danger, it seems to me, of perfectionism, that, well, since we can't perform surgery in a perfectly aseptic environment, we may as well do it in a sewer. I mean, in other words, the danger with aspiring to perfectionism is that once you discover that you can't arrive there, you can so easily, and this has happened historically again and again, flip to the other extreme and just say, well, you know, we're all equally in a manner. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it contributes to this very thing, that it sort of saps human agency, because you begin to despair over any time reaching perfectionism, and then you kind of give up the game. So it seems to me that grace in that sense is empowering, because it spares you from being hung up on perfectionism, so that you can roll up your sleeves and get to work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that it leads to a kind of work that's not in place of work.
I think it's very hard to cure perfectionists, and despairers are just perfectionists at the other end of the spectrum. It's but I'm always a little baffled by, you know, part of what I hope to do here in this presentation was to show that it's not, that actions for earth justice are also found in congregations that talk about wife abuse. That is, a congregational forum dealing with wife abuse is also a forum on ecological justice, because the patterns are structurally the same in the West. The oppression of women. The teeter-totter has, friends, this is too simple, isn't it? All these things are always too simple. The teeter-totter has been basically like that as well in the West. And it's the rape of the earth metaphor isn't accidental. And we need to start talking, not in a competitive way again, that's the old model. We need to start talking how the how mine stripping in West Virginia, strip mining in West Virginia and North Dakota, are not unrelated, to put it most minimally, to the understanding of the disciplining of children through physical corporal punishment. They're historically connected. There's a wonderful book called Spare the Child by Greven, G-R-E-V-E-N, showing how evangelical Protestant theology in the United States has inevitably expressed itself in corporal punishment of children. It's a brilliant book and directly connected with how we understand power over in nature. I go on too long. Yes, sir.
Going back to the evil brushes and evil canvases and evil cameras, isn't that an ethics, an idea that you can have the lesser evil for the greater good?
Yes.
And doesn't God work both through evil and through good?
Yes, that certainly has been claimed theologically.
If we see that God is more in a circle than in compartments.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no problem with Rembrandt using a brush made out of hair from a goat or a pig or what.
Yeah, I think the possibility for a new opening there is to say, yes, sometimes a lesser evil can be used, can be morally justified to obtain a greater moral good. That's the case. I would add a qualification. And that is that the judge of the moral justification of that must be those who are most disadvantaged in the result. And that's really just drawing on Aquinas, of the distribution of benefits and burdens. And that's where it usually goes wrong. It's usually the powerful who decide whether this lesser evil will justify their greater good.
I think the way we're going to have to correct the whole problem right now, we're supposed to have peace in the world, and we have such a large defense budget. A lot of that money is that we're no longer going to have to use. We're going to have to go out and buy somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 square miles of the United States, and then start over. It sounds like a big wild project, but that's probably what's going to have to happen. Start right from square one and take all of our knowledge that we know today and put it into it and make it a large model and then pyramid up from there.
There's a long tradition of that in the United States, isn't there? To try to find a plot of land to start over and do it right this time. It's like always the United States is in part this notion that somewhere here Eden exists, and we're gonna find it. The those supermarket periodicals like National Enquirer, the Weekly Reader, whatever one that is, the other, not the National Enquirer, the other one. 2 weeks ago, I bought it for the second time in my life because the whole cover story was Adam and Eve found south of Denver. They had the skeletons, and it was the Garden of Eden. And I thought, only in the United States would this be a big seller. No. But there's a lot of truth in what I'm just pointing out, that it's part of a pattern.
We can't do it on a scale of a 3,000 acres or 4,000 acres. The problem is so wild that we have to take such a large, large block of land to make a difference. And for the human mind to actually see what we have, the problems that we have caused, and to get it back into correction.
Are you involved in any projects toward that kind of a major project?
Little I'm ones a real estate for investor, and I want to build land. I just acquired about a 50-acre farm here not too long ago, and I don't plan on subdividing or anything.